I'd like to open today by turning back to Genesis chapter 31, if you want to head back there. To set the stage of this chapter, we're right in the smack of the middle of the patriarch era, and the focus of the story now has turned to Jacob. Jacob, this troublemaker, has fled from his brother Esau. He's gone all the way to his uncle Laban's house, and he's been earnestly working off some debts through manual labor in order to marry Leah and Rachel. By the time we get to chapter 31 here, we get to kind of a critical junction in the life of Jacob where he can no longer stay with Laban. And he's ready to pack up his wives, his possessions, and just hightail it out of town. I want to pick it up in verse 1 here. Genesis chapter 31, starting in verse 1. Says, "Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, 'Jacob has taken away all that was our father's. And from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth.' And Jacob saw that the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable towards him as before. And then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you.' So Jacob sent, and he called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock. And he said, 'Look, I see your father's countenance. It's not great right now, and at least not as great as it has been. So we need to get out.' So they need to go. Laban's not happy. Things are starting to turn sour here. So it's time for these two groups just to separate, go their separate ways. So Jacob tells everyone to get ready, get their things, pack up, let's head out. Let's drop down to verse 17 now, still in Genesis 31. It says, "Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock, all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock, which he had gained in this town, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan." Well, now here in verse 19, we get a little sidebar that is easy to skip over, but I want to notice what it says here. Verse 19 says, "Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep," he's way out in the field, "and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's." Okay, it's a little strange to steal those idols. Maybe she had an attachment to them of some kind. Maybe she was just trying to get back at her dad in some way. It doesn't really say here explicitly. Seems though that maybe Jacob didn't instill this soul worship of Yahweh flawlessly here if these household idols were still a draw. But we do have to keep in mind the context of that time. It was not unusual in the ancient Near East to have several layers of gods. You could very much have a national god. You could have a regional god. And certainly, you could have a household god or a lesser god in the pantheon of gods. And that would not have been unusual at the time at all. Kind of like a middle manager, so to speak, in the realm of gods. He was not too important so that he would still hear their request, but he was important enough that he could still get a few things done. That's kind of the bucket that these household idols fell into. So Laban, he chastens after them. He says, "It's okay to leave. I get it. You can go now. But you got to take my idols at the same time?" Let's drop down to verse 32 now, still in 31. Verse 32 of chapter 31, this is Jacob responding. He says, "With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live." I don't think he knew about this Rachel issue yet. "In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you." For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban, he went into Jacob's tent, then he went into Leah's tent, and the two maids' tents, he didn't find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and he entered Rachel's. Verse 34. Now Rachel had taken the household idols. She put them in a camel's saddle, and then she sat on them. And Laban searched all around the tent. He didn't find them. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of woman is with me." And he searched and he searched, but he didn't find those idols. So my question is, why is this story in the Bible? The Bible is such an interesting and a unique book. And at sometimes it feels like a really long book. Like it goes into a lot of minutia and minute details about some topics. Other times, though, it feels like a very short book. And it will just gloss over huge topics or giant time frames without much or any commentary at all. So here we have this story about household idols. And this feels a little bit like it could have been cut from the first draft of the Bible and made room for something else. Well, the people of the Old Testament generally, and certainly including the nation of Israel specifically, but throughout the time of the people God worked with, God showed that they had an issue with idols. And here it shows that it was an issue even with this family, even at this time. But the really interesting part of this story, and one of the reasons why I love the Bible and think it is so awesome, is that wrapped into this story is also a subtle commentary about the worthlessness of idols, all wrapped into an account about someone really seeking after them. And here in this story, the idols are shown to be pathetic. They failed three times. They couldn't keep themselves from being stolen. They couldn't keep themselves from being sat on, which was a grave insult in that culture. And third, due to Rachel's bodily functions, they couldn't even keep themselves from being ritually unclean. That's three strikes for these idols. For an object that had some type of hold on, at least Rachel, the writer is demonstrating that they were in reality a sad, worthless nothing. If only it were that easy for the rest of the people in the Old Testament to come to that same understanding. Today, I'd like to talk about the second commandment. That commandment, as we will read shortly, deals with idols. And it is an issue that plagued the nation of Israel from start to finish. From the time they were led out of Egypt all the way till when they were carted off into captivity and everywhere in the middle. It's an issue that gets revisited over and over and over again in the Bible. But also, at the same time, it's a commandment that can also feel a little bit, at least on the surface, like it's not also super relevant for us today. I mean, we aren't carving statues. I wouldn't even know how to make something out of wood and cast it in bronze, even if I had all the honey in the world. And frankly, the idea of building something, getting down on my knees and worshiping it, that seems so far-fetched, so antiquated, so ridiculous, that it's hard to know how this commandment really applies into my daily life anymore. And even secular, non-religious people, they're not going to keep the other commandments. You know, they're not going to keep the Sabbath or something like that. But I guess they kind of get to check this one off by default, I guess, because they're also not making idols or worshiping them. So I guess they just get a free pass on commandment number two. Well, I'd like to propose to you today that this commandment is still very much applicable to us. It's talking about worshiping carved images, of course, but also it's about so much more. It's a key component about how we relate to God, how we understand who He is and what He is all about. And of course, it's an important facet on how He wants our relationship with Him to function. It's so much more than just about sculpting a stone exclusively. So let's go back to the actual commandment in Exodus chapter 20. This is one of the scriptures, one of the commandments that is the exact same in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. As you know, not all of them are identical in both places, but this one is. And as you're turning back there, I thought it was interesting that while we call it the Ten Commandments, they're never actually called that in the Bible. There are a few places where our English translation renders that Ten Commandments. There's one in Exodus 34, verse 28. There's another one in Deuteronomy 4, verse 13. But the literal meaning is the Ten Words. And just what those 10 words are is subject to a lot of debate over the years. It's one of the contributing factors about why there's a disagreement in the numbering system of the commandments, and even in some cases, the total number of what those commandments are. Now, we've come to consider it the second commandment, of course, and it starts in Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 and 5 and 6. It's the second longest commandment, trailing only the Sabbath. We'll read it here, verse 4 of Exodus 20. It says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image." That's petzel. A petzel. A carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Verse 5, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So there's a lot to unpack here just in these three verses. Interesting that it explicitly mentions these three different areas: heaven above, earth beneath, and waters under the earth. In the ancient Near East, these three divisions were often used to describe the different components of cosmology as they understood it. You had heavens, or up in the sky, and that's not just exclusively birds and things like that, it included that, but also spirits or heavenly bodies or things that are just kind of up there in a different realm. The earth beneath would be all the physical things that people would interact with all the time and touch with and could see. And the waters beneath, that's sea creatures, of course, but not exclusively. The people of the time would also understand that to mean things of the dead or things of the underworldly sort of areas. In other words, God is using language that they would have understood to mean every possible thing. Every possible thing. God is very explicit. He leaves it in very clear terms. Nothing. Nothing physical, nothing metaphysical, nothing mystical, just nothing. Full stop. And it's interesting to me that this commandment is also in Islam as well. And if anything, the Islamic religion takes this to a little bit more of an extreme. They're definitely more strict in this interpretation, which is why if you look at any of the artwork in the centuries after Islam started, you won't see any depictions of anything living at all. When Sarah and I went over to Egypt and the Middle East and we visited Islamic areas, and you see all these intricate geometric patterns and things that are designed in that way, and one of the reasons is because the artist specialized in that art form because they weren't drawing anything or depicting anything living at all. Now, we understand that this commandment is not prohibiting the drawing or the painting of any living thing. You don't have to turn back there, but just a few chapters later in Exodus chapter 20, God gives directives on the tabernacle design, and he tells them to include heavenly things. That includes the cherubim, and also includes regular physical things like oxen and plants and things like that. So it's not just about drawing or representing living things in general, but it's about a worship context, depicting God as something created, or creating something and using that in a worship context. So I want to take this commandment and I want to come at it from three different angles today, three different perspectives on what this commandment can mean to us modern-day Christians. The first is that idolatry can include desires that overtake our relationship with God. Idolatry is any desires that overtake our relationship with God. Secondly, it is wrong to represent God in any form. It is wrong to represent God in any form. And then lastly, we'll come at this from a little bit of an unusual perspective and see that God actually did create some things in his image, as you well know, and we'll walk through why that was done and how it relates back to this commandment. So perspective number one, idolatry can include any desires that overtake our relationship with God. The commandment as it is worded in Exodus and Deuteronomy is talking about literal objects used in a worship context. But the Bible does go on to extend it in principle in several other areas, one of which is in Ezekiel chapter 14, if you want to turn back there. Ezekiel chapter 14. Now, Ezekiel has a lot of warnings and prophecies for the nation of Israel, and along with it, as we'll see in chapter 14, it has some of the rationale as to why those negative actions will take place. And idolatry, of course, played a huge role. Let's jump in verse 1 of Ezekiel 14. Ezekiel 14, verse 1. It says, "Now some of the elders of Israel came to me and sat before me." They're sitting before Ezekiel. "And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their hearts." Okay, that can't be a physical thing. and put before them that which causes them to stumble into iniquity. Should I let myself be inquired at all by them?" So obviously this was in a figurative sense here. These weren't literal idols crafted from a physical material, but rather it was desires that they had driven into their heart or their emotional core that was in direct contradiction to God's way of life. Verse 4, "Therefore speak to them and say to them, thus says the Lord God, everyone of the house of Israel who sets up idols in his heart and puts before him what causes him to stumble into iniquity, and then comes to the prophet, I, the Lord, will answer him who comes according to the multitude of his idols, that I may seize the house of Israel by their heart, because they are all estranged from me by their idols." As we know from the history of the Israelites, that certainly did include physical idolatry, but also included a whole bunch of other desires that pulled them away from that model nation they were supposed to be. Likewise, in the New Testament, this concept was also expanded upon. Peter mentions it in 1 Peter chapter 4. We don't need to turn back there, but it says that before conversion, we all spent too much of our energy and effort in lewdness, revelries, and idolatries. And that was written, of course, to the Jews, and they would have never put up a physical idol, but yet spiritual idolatry was still very much a factor to that audience. Now, I do want to notice a comment by Paul in Colossians chapter 3. You can head back there, Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, we'll start in verse 1 here as well. Colossians 3, verse 1. It says, "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth." So we're jumping into the thought here, but the focus is about changing your perspective away from worldly desires and instead refocusing on developing godly character. And how do you do that? Well, it's by showing love to your neighbor. It's by loving God with all your heart, all your desires. That's all of the commandments distilled. But what's the inverse of that? Verse 5. "Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desires, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them." So as a result, it is a right and a proper extrapolation to take the second commandment and apply it to desires that become a higher priority in our life. You can say that anything can become a spiritual idol if it supersedes our relationship with the one true God, or if it diverts our focus from his way of life. Just as physical idols redirected worship to something invalid, so can these spiritual idols redirect our attention and our focus to something equally invalid. But at the same time, the commandment also meant something very specific to the Israelites as it was given to them. And it's still very much applicable to us, even if we have no desire to go off and 3D print a new physical idol. That's perspective number two, is it is wrong to represent God in any form. And I want to head back to the golden calf incident in Exodus, if you want to go back to Exodus 19. We're very familiar with this story, and it's quite interesting, at least to me, in the context of what Israel was experiencing at this time. And doubly so when we think about this whole experience that God was using as he drew them out of Egypt, that was designed to get the Israelites to think about their God in a totally unique way. He wanted to have a unique relationship with them, which was already a foreign concept for people at that time. And in order for that to happen, he has to get them to reset how they think this relationship can be. Reset everything that they knew about how the gods worked. And as we remember, they had just come out of Egypt not too long ago. They had made a trek across part of the desert here. And they have all these signs, all these wonders, all these miracles. And when they finally get to Mount Sinai, it was an overwhelming experience. I want to start in Exodus chapter 19, pick up the thread here. Exodus 19, we'll start in verse 1. It says, in the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day, they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Okay, so there's this huge and great series of events that is culminating in chapter 19. This was a very big day for the nation of Israel. This was the day that they were really to learn that not just that their God was more powerful than the gods of Egypt, but rather that their God, this Yahweh, was entirely different than anything they understood a God could be. Let's drop down to verse 16. Still in Exodus 19, now verse 16. It says, then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in a fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice. And at that point, we get the Decathlon, or the 10 words, or the 10 phrases, 10 commandments. Let's keep going now. Let's go to chapter 20, verse 18. Chapter 20, verse 18 now. It says, now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. And they said to Moses, you speak with us, and we will hear. But, you know, let's not do this with God, lest we die. So this was a remarkable series of events here. It had to be an amazing sight to behold. People are literally fearing for their lives. They're like shaking out of fear here. And what follows next is a few chapters of additional instructions and regulations. And Israel affirms this covenant. And then Moses, he goes up on the mountain in chapter 24. And he was there a little while. People start to get a little restless. Now, I've tried to put myself in their shoes, at least their frame of mind. You know, it's almost impossible because it's a different time, a different culture, of course. And I've never been in a situation anywhere close to what they're experiencing. But one thing's for sure is they've had a lot of trauma in their lives. I mean, not only slavery, which of course is its own thing, but then coming out of slavery, crossing the Red Sea as the Egyptians are barreling down on them, all of these miracles, coming to a mountain that is basically on fire and shooting lightning everywhere. I mean, I think they all would have needed a little bit of professional counseling at the end of this. But it's all within this context that we get to chapter 32 and the golden calf incident. And now I used to think, what did they just, did they forget about God? But how could they? How could they? They were just fearing for their lives a second ago. You know, they have not recovered from all of that trauma that they just experienced. Did they suddenly think that another God could be more powerful than what they just experienced? I'm not so sure about that. So what is happening here? Exodus 32, verse 1. Exodus 32, verse 1. It says, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as is Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what came of him. And Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me. So they all the people broke off their golden earrings. They brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned with it with an engraving tool, and he made a golden calf. And then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now notice this next verse, though. Verse 5. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord, is a feast to Yahweh." Now, some commentaries here, they think that, or at least they suggest, that Aaron is just using this feast to Yahweh as a stalling tactic, saying that maybe he can just have him hold out a little bit more, then Moses will fix everything. And I guess that may be true. It had to be a very hard mental switch for the Israelites. They had come from a land of Egypt where they saw depictions of their gods in statues, in pillars, in everywhere. If they needed to have some rain, they could walk up to the rain god, his little area. They could see the rain god. They could say a prayer and they could walk away. They could, in their mind, visualize what each god looked like and what their purpose was and kind of organize them into their own little box. Conceptually, they could get their hands around what each one did. Now keep this in mind and turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 5. This is right before the giving of the commandments a second time. Now, as we said earlier, this is Deuteronomy 4 where we're going. As we said earlier, God had a lot of work with these people to try to get them to change how they think, how they understood who and what Yahweh was. This was no easy task. And the Israelites, they didn't help their cause all that much sometimes. But let's jump into Deuteronomy 4. The first part of this chapter is a recap of what we just discussed. Verse 11 is talking about the mountain that terrified them. Verse 13 is the Ten Commandments are talking about them. And we're going to start in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 4. Deuteronomy 4, verse 15, this is God speaking here. He says, "Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire." Well, why? Why was that so important? "Lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image, a betzel, in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, or the likeness of any bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, fish, you name it." Verse 19, "And take heed, lest you lift your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and moon and stars, all the host of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage." God's reiterating here, you didn't see anything. You couldn't fix an image in your mind and say, "This is what our God now looks like, and this is what he does." You couldn't take some facet of God and visually fix it in a point in time. You couldn't take all that is God and reduce it down to something so small that it could actually be represented by an artist. In a much smaller example, it's like trying to demonstrate the luminosity of a diamond showing a picture drawn with crayons. Even if the Israelites had the best intentions, and I'm not sure they did, but even if they had the best intentions and they wanted to worship Yahweh and only Yahweh, but they just wanted to represent him in a physical way in the image of a calf so that they could wrap their minds around it a little bit more. And in doing so, they have shrunken the all-powerful creator of the universe, something beyond creation, into something created, something small, something comparatively insignificant. Part of how God rescued them from the Egyptians was to painstakingly show through the plagues that he had power over all of the so-called Egyptian gods, that he was stronger, more powerful. And when he took them out to Mount Sinai and he thundered out his commandments, he was equally painstakingly showing them that they needed to think of a God, not just as an object, but in terms of what his character is and what the relationship he wanted to have with them. One of our commentaries has this to add. This is from the UCG booklet. It says, "A physical image, a painting, or a picture of a deity has neither life nor power. Even if we knew exactly what God looks like, which we don't, we could not design icons that would accurately portray the awesome power and radiant glory of God, as well as the many facets of his character revealed to us through his word. Sometimes God acts with gentleness and mercy, and at other times he acts with great wrath and might. He does not want us to perceive him as frozen in any one trait of personality or character to the exclusion of his many other traits. He instead asks that we read about him, learn what he is like, and then emulate him. Now, the commandment prohibiting idols isn't just about worshiping false gods through idols. It's even about how we worship the true God through a static representation that can never do him justice. Now, we have a good friend, Sarah and I do, that's in a different Christian religion, and we were talking about this sermon, actually. And one of the questions that came up was about idols, and I asked her why icons. If you've ever been to another church that has these icons that people use, I asked her why icons were not considered a form of idols. And this individual said that it's not the icon or the image itself that is being worshipped, but rather it is used to focus worship through an icon to the ultimate source. That's what she said. And I would propose that God does not want us to use any object that stands before him as a pathway, as a conduit to our relationship and our worship towards him. He made it very clear that nothing from heaven above, on earth below, or waters underneath, nothing that has ever been created or ever will be created can be used to worship the one that is outside of creation, the creator of all things. The last perspective that I like to focus on might be in a connection that you haven't thought of before, because while we are told not to make anything in God's image, there are some things that were made in God's image. That's point number three, or perspective number three, is there are things intentionally made in God's image. There are things intentionally made in God's image. And as the commandment explicitly states, we are not to create a carved image or likeness of God. But again, there are at least two things that are created in the likeness of God. I'm sure at least one of them popped right into your mind right away. And it's in Genesis chapter 1. If you want to head back there. Genesis chapter 1. This is, of course, human beings. Human beings. Genesis chapter 1, we'll pick it up in verse 24. Both of these, human beings, and the second one we'll mention here in just a second, both are designed to help us connect back to that relationship with our Heavenly Father. Genesis 1, verse 24 says, "Then God said, 'Let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind.' And so it was. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind." So each was in its own little bucket, was for its own little purpose, and God saw that it was good. Verse 26, "Then God said," memory scripture here, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image.'" This word here is teslem. It's a different word. Teslem, this word is used in other places, sometimes in a negative sense, referring to an idol. "Let us make man in our image," teslem, "according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image, and in the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So it's interesting that we have this delineation, the separation between animals made in their own image for their own thing, their own purpose, versus human beings made in another image or in the semblance or the likeness of God. Now, the second instance of something that is made in the image of God the Father is Jesus Christ. Let's notice this in Colossians chapter 1. This is our second one that we'll cover, then we'll pull them together. Colossians 1, we'll start in verse 9 here of Colossians 1. It says, "For this reason we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you, and ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding. Verse 10, Colossians 1:10, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might, according to his glorious power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. Verse 13, he has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Now, when we think about these two examples, they both connect back to the second commandment. And I think it does so by adding clarity on what God is trying to do. He's trying to get us to rethink, reset, reorient our relationship with him. And he makes it clear that you can't think of him in terms of created things. He's beyond that. There's no place for that. But there are some things that he did put in place to help facilitate that understanding of what he is like. Not visually, though. Not in terms of objects and physical things, but rather spiritual components that help illustrate spiritual parts of his character, his way of life, and his very nature. We aren't left with a commandment that says, you can never understand anything about me, so don't even try. But rather, that's not it at all. Instead, he is saying, don't limit what I am. Don't draw me down to these small, insignificant things. Instead, understand more about me through my words, through my laws, through my regulations, and through the examples I have given you. And understand that I want to have a relationship with you, to understand more about how I think. Look to the example of Jesus Christ to see more of my character demonstrated, amplified. These are both made in the image, or maybe said in a different way, these are both vignettes that help illustrate facets of the most impressive being in ways that we can actually digest. It's the exact opposite of what idolatry does. Idolatry limits and constricts and creates a character of God. But once you understand through the first commandment that there is only one God, then the second commandment then lays the groundwork about how to actually think and connect and have a relationship with him. Let's bring it all together by going back to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. This is Paul as he's traveling through and around, and he's talking about Jesus Christ. And he's going into places that had a wide understanding of the spiritual realm and how gods might or might not have worked and what those gods wanted and what they needed to give to them and et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to pick up the thread in verse 16 of Acts 17. And this is when he arrives in Athens. Acts chapter 17, verse 16 says, now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. Now, I'm sure you remember and have it mentioned before that the quantity of statues and worship items in Athens at this time was really unbelievable. It was such a cosmopolitan city at that time that everyone could have their own flavors or their own varieties of gods to worship, and you could go into those temples or those areas and worship to your fancy. Verse 17, therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshipers and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. And then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, well, what does this babbler want to say? Another said, he seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. We'll drop down to verse 22. And then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. He would go on to say that it's not just that he's just another god here, one more to add to your pantheon of gods, or some slightly different flavor of God, but rather he was something totally different. Verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwelling, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might find, or they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Verse 29, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devisings. To think that this God that gave life to all, that sustains all, that has no needs, but has all power, all might, how silly is it that that being could be represented in something like a statue or a drawing or a carving? Well, in conclusion, I wanted to quote from a book called Unveiling Mercy. Sarah gave this book out a little while ago. It's by the author Chad Bird. And in his book, he takes a Hebrew word each day and he goes through and he elaborates on it. And so on day 78, he tackles patzel. That is the Hebrew word given for graven image or carven image back in our commandment. And he has this to say on patzel, quote, said in 63 BC, when the Roman general Pompey captured Jerusalem and he entered the temple, he must have been surprised to find no image of their God. His surprise would have been shared by any persons in the ancient world. All deities had statues, poles, carvings, or images, which served as a kind of visual rendezvous between the gods and their worshipers. No Yahweh, though. Every carved image or patzel of God was banned on pain of death. Images of angels, oxen, and flowers were in the temple, but not Israel's Lord. Why? Because he had not yet given them his image. End quote. Now, the first three commandments specifically help to illustrate how God wants us to think about him. He is different than how we could possibly think of a God. Nothing can capture or to fully represent what he is in a physical form. And through these first three commandments, we understand that he stands alone, that there is nothing else like him, and that we respect his name. We cannot capture that understanding in a picture, in a carving, in an artifact, or you name it. Our God is bigger than all of that. And incredibly enough, this is the same God that sent his Son to die for us and to have a relationship with us for all eternity. And if this is something that anyone can fully comprehend, you'll have to tell me how. But I am very thankful for it. When we think about the second commandment, let us make sure we don't strictly think of metal handiwork of eons ago, or rather that this commandment is a dated relic from a time long past. But rather, let us take to the heart that God is much bigger than anything that is created because he is entirely outside of creation. So let us continue to learn about his character and his way of life, and to eagerly long for that eternal life in his glorious presence forever.